another public resignation by an air traffic controller. What can we learn? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. My guest today is Doug Pincock, who is the facilities representative of the National Air Traffic Controllers Association for Salt Lake Center. Doug, thanks for joining us, and tell us a little bit about how the FAA facilities are organized at Salt Lake.
Well, I work in an en route air traffic control facility. We handle en route traffic that travels across the United States. The area that we provide coverage for runs from about Cedar City, Utah, all the way north to the Canadian border, encompasses airspace within the states of Montana, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Idaho, Utah, and Nevada.
That's a fairly big area. I think for our listeners on the East Coast, sometimes they don't have the perspective of how far apart things can be when you get west of the Mississippi.
Yeah, it's actually, I believe that it's the largest geographical chunk of airspace that any center controls.
Okay, but your job with NATCA and Salt Lake is to be the facilities representative, and that's kind of the context in which we're here to talk to you today. And this is about a letter from Greg Bean, who looks like was hired in May of 2005 to train with the FAA to become a certified professional. What exactly is the end of the line for training there called? Certified professional controller?
Correct. We refer to them as CPCs, and I think that's the way he kind of refers to it in his letter.
Okay. Let me read just a little bit from his resignation letter, which was made public in the last week, just to kind of set the stage for our listeners. He informs Sherry Butler of FAA that he's leaving on May 27th to transfer to a new position with the Department of Defense, and says, quote, "In May of 2005, I accepted a position with the Federal Aviation Administration in Salt Lake City. I was told at that time that although I would be taking a significant pay reduction at first, I would earn this pay back as I progressed through the training, and when I completed the training, I would be back to the earnings I was making in my former position with the Department of Defense. However, a little more than halfway through my training program, the FAA took back this proposal, and I was left earning $30,000 less than I was earning in my previous position. To make matters worse, those performing the same job I am, who completed the training prior to those pay cuts, were able to keep their pay. Now I'm working next to other controllers who are making $30,000 plus more than I am and are performing the exact same job. In addition, many of these controllers have far less air traffic control experience than I do. I've been an air traffic controller for over 10 years. Now, I guess I'd have a couple of questions regarding this part of his letter. To whom are incoming recruits talking at the FAA when they are being promised a specific pay level? And do they not understand that there's a contract, a union contract involved that may change during the course of their tenure there?
Originally, they receive some kind of correspondence from some administrative personnel, essentially extending an offer for employment to the possible candidates. They either accept or decline the offer, and those are usually made based on the current information. In the past, we have never seen a reduction in pay. It's always been an increase or some kind of status quo. So when he was extended an offer, he was looking at what he considered to be a better job opportunity with the FAA at equal or better pay than he was receiving with the Department of Defense. And so he accepted the offer. Once he showed up, after he was here for a little while, as part of the negotiations that ended in impasse and the agency finally implemented some imposed work rules, they reduced the amount of pay that they were going to offer these individuals. And we had several who were kind of caught midstream, where they were told one wage and then their wage was essentially frozen, and they were told, you know what, we're not going to pay you anymore.
I guess from a contract or labor law standpoint, the FAA cannot be held to even written correspondence that offers a particular pay level if a union contract or I won't call it an agreement because you guys didn't agree to it, but it is, I suppose, at some level a contract. Subsequent contract comes along and reverses the pay that was in that original letter. Is that kind of the premise of how this can happen?
Yeah, we refer to them as imposed work rules, actually just like you said, because they were not agreed to, but they were forced upon us without what we consider a fair impasse procedure having been utilized. But once they changed the terms, that's just pretty much what they've gone with. They've just imposed their own will.
What's happening between the FAA and the Department of Defense? Because I've heard anecdotal stories about a couple of different people who have come over from DOD to the FAA to become controllers. Is the FAA actively recruiting among military controllers? And if they are, what can the FAA offer in a civilian position? Well, actually, I guess a DOD controller is a civilian position. What does the FAA have to offer these folks that they don't think they will get from the Department of Defense positions as military controllers?
For some of them, it's a new geographic location, or it might be a better opportunity. It used to be within the FAA that you could hire into a facility. After some time there, you could request to relocate. You could bid on larger facilities with a little more complexity, higher traffic levels, and the FAA would allow you to move around. Right now, for most of us, there is no movement whatsoever. If you wanted to voluntarily relocate to another location, at least within the en route facilities, there's really no movement. That was one of the opportunities that would be presented to those DOD controllers. They would have a little more flexibility in movement.
Or perhaps in some cases, the freedom to not have to move all the time.
Correct. And in some instances, they were offered a better wage than what they were making at the Department of Defense.
How similar is the job between a Department of Defense controller and an FAA controller? In other words, how much of that DOD experience coming over is valuable?
The experience as a controller, the rules that they apply are essentially the same rules that we do as far as separating aircraft. In Greg's case, he came from a facility where he was working in a TRACON-type environment. That's a terminal radar approach control.
Mm-hmm.
So he was using radar. He was using essentially the same equipment that we have here in the center environment in order to provide services for the Department of Defense, but not all of those jobs are that way. Some DOD controllers come from towers or things like that. So there are just some differences between what the tower controllers do and what an en route controller does.
Is this letter, is this circumstance that Greg found himself in an isolated one? Because obviously we don't see all the resignation letters that come from controllers leaving the FAA. And obviously there are also some stories with retirees leaving for various reasons before they might otherwise leave that don't even result in the generation of a letter. It's hard for us on the outside to know, really, when NATCA releases a resignation letter like this publicly as a kind of press release, whether this is an isolated incident being kind of blown up because NATCA seems to have kind of an agenda to discredit the FAA. And in all fairness, it's one of the few tactics available to a union that can't strike. But is this isolated, or does this happen more often than we know?
You know, I don't know that I can accurately address that. It does happen more frequently, and there are indications that it's going to happen again in the future here. The controllers came on under the premise of making one wage. They take an initial pay cut because you're in a training status when you first hire with the FAA, but they're expecting to make that back over time. They've been told now that they're never going to reclaim or recoup that pay cut that they took. They'll never make the same wage that they were with the Department of Defense. So for a lot of them, they can go back and be treated better and be paid better to perform essentially a little bit less work with the Department of Defense than they are with the FAA.
All right, we're going to talk about this idea of how they're treated, too, when we come back. We need to take a break, Doug, but we'll be back in a moment. My guest today is Doug Pincock, who is the facilities representative for NATCA in Salt Lake City, and you're listening to Aero News.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com. Higher, faster, farther, safer. Those are the watchwords of Columbia Aircraft Manufacturing's new generation of personal airplanes. The Columbia 350 and 400 are now available with either an Abadyn or Garmin electronic cockpit. The new Garmin G1000 equipped Columbia 350 and 400 have just been introduced with the new ReadyPad. While the G1000 panel integrates all navigation and flight instruments into two high-resolution screens, incorporating GPS, nav, comm, autopilot, transponder, and flight director into one easy-to-use package. To schedule a demo flight in a Columbia 350 or the turbocharged 400, call 541-318-1144 or check them out on the web at flycolumbia.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today about a resignation letter from a controller in Salt Lake, which was forwarded on to the media by the National Association of Air Traffic Controllers. In this case, a fellow named Greg Bean resigned and is going back to his old job or a similar job that he left at the Department of Defense after becoming somewhat disillusioned with the promises coming in the door made to him by the FAA versus the reality that took place after the imposed work rules that came down in 2006. We're talking with Doug Pincock, who is the facility's representative at the Salt Lake facility. And Doug, again, thanks for taking a few minutes out today. I want to ask you about some of the specific circumstances that Greg mentions in his letter. And let me just read you part of this paragraph. The pay was only the beginning of the frustrations I have encountered with the FAA. In February of 2006, I was asked to help move furniture out of the building, though we were not provided with the proper materials to do this moving. As a result, I received an injury to my hand that would require surgery, as well as many months of physical therapy. And he goes on to say that it was compounded by little assistance from the FAA, and FAA, in fact, providing wrong forms, not signing forms before they were sent, and in general contributing to a prolonging of this process that he calls a major ordeal in his life. Was NATCA involved at any point along the way in trying to help him through this process? It occurs to me that in union environments where I've been in the past, if the boss came in and said, hey, guys, we're going to move furniture today, someone would raise their hand and say, excuse me. Is there any process like that that may have taken place here, or did everybody just kind of go along?
Well, you're talking about individuals who are in a probationary state. For the first year of employment with the FAA, they are probationary. Which essentially means that the agency can remove them from the service with or without cause. And it's actually a well-known fact that all of the managers at the end, or as the end of their probationary period approaches, they sit down and review and have a discussion about the employee to decide whether or not they think they're going to be a good employee. If they don't like them, they let them go. And there's no recourse that the employee has. They're specifically excluded as a probationary employee from some of the other rights that are afforded us under a contract with appeal rights and things like that. They're just terminated at the whim of the agency. So you've got a classroom full of individuals who are up there studying, drawing maps, doing some classroom work. Their direct supervisor comes in and says, we've got a closet with some surplus equipment and things that we want to throw out. Are any of you interested in helping remove that? Who's not going to say, yeah, sure. They're thinking it's going to be light lifting. It's no big deal. Plus, it lets them get out, stretch their legs, get them out of the classroom. Plus, they want to please their supervisor because he's going to have some influence in whether or not they're retained.
Well, now, at the end of this process, this training process, which takes anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the job and how the training progresses, The FAA has an awful lot of money invested in each one of these guys. Is it really common for them to just be dismissed, you know, without any particular cause at the end of a training program, or I guess the first year's probationary period?
We have had some who have been who were released where they essentially said, you know, you don't fit our bill of goods, so we're going to let you go.
Okay.
And some of those individuals, in all fairness, found themselves in, I guess, some less than favorable circumstances, maybe with some of their behavior or with some of their actions. But the agency used that as kind of their grounds to make their decision, I'm sure.
All right. Greg goes on in his letter and he says in closing that this brings me to my next major concern. The environment at the FAA has gone from bad to worse in the last year, and I blame management for a great deal of this. The comments such as, quote, the door is to the right, unquote, is just one example indicating that we are not valued employees. Let me ask you, because the FAA obviously is under a crunch to recruit people. Once they get someone who appears to be qualified in the door and trained for a year, it would seem like there's an overwhelming incentive for the agency to try to maintain, you know, the workforce, keep as many of these people on board as they can. Has the environment deteriorated to the point where people are actually being told, hey, the door's on the right if you don't like it?
Yes, I believe, although I was not present at the meeting that he's referring to, I believe that that's a direct quote from the facility manager, Sherry Butler, that she made to several trainees. She was talking about when these work rules were first imposed and that their pay would be affected. The essence of it was, we've got lots of applicants and plenty of people who are interested in the job, and if this doesn't work for you, you know what? The door's there to your right. And that, and I believe that that somewhat mirrors a quote that was made by Rick Day, the vice president for en route operations, that he made to a group of academy students down in Oklahoma City.
Tell me about staffing levels at Salt Lake. How have they changed, first of all, under the old 1997 staffing level agreement between the union and the FAA, and the FAA's new adjusted ranges of staffing? How many positions did you lose from one list to the other, and how are they staffing at this point?
We previously had a negotiated staffing level of 219 controllers, and that would have included CPCs and then developmental controllers. Those are the ones who are in training and going through that. It would also include temporary promotions to staff positions or things like that, where individuals would temporarily move into an office, they would perform some support work, and then they would be returning to the control room to, you know, at the end of, say, a two-year period, they would return back to be a controller full-time.
Right.
The new range that they have for us is between 162 and 198. That's the range that they say that we can, that they want to staff us at. Right now, we are showing 210 on board, with 163 of those being CPCs and 47 being developmentals.
The range that they quote is including the developmentals as well as the CPCs. In theory, right now, you're over the top end of their new range.
Correct. But as far as CPCs, we're as low as we've ever been, and it's just getting worse.
Well, and obviously, as this letter makes clear, not all those developmentals will eventually come online as CPCs.
That's correct. It's a fairly low washout rate, but we're starting to see more and more of those who aren't making it through and who don't care about trying to go to a smaller facility. It used to be that they would take individuals who failed at the busier facilities and move them to the smaller facilities. And there are a lot of these kids who aren't interested in going to the smaller facilities because the pay is substandard.
All right. Well, Doug, I appreciate your helping us flesh out Greg's resignation letter. And it's unfortunate to hear that things like this are happening. I don't really know. I mean, we're kind of at a loss here out here in the world, listening to the arguments coming from the FAA on one side and NATCA on the other, to always know exactly where in the middle somewhere the you know, the truth is. But I think you've helped us to get an idea that, at least in Greg's case, he was caught at a particular point in time where, like a lot of other people who might have come into the FAA at that time, he was given an expectation that from the union standpoint over the years was a reasonable expectation and you know, not it didn't need to be questioned at that time. Let me ask you one final question, though. At this point, when people come in the door, is somebody from NACA taking them aside and saying, you know, there's a couple of things you ought to know about the process here?
Well, the process changed for everybody when they imposed their work rules in September of last year. And for Greg in particular, he just happened to be, and he's not the only one who was in this boat here at this facility or even nationwide, where you've got a lot of individuals who came in under one premise and then the agency changed it on everybody, not, you know, without, again, any agreement from the union or otherwise. And that was, you know, the pay is one piece, but Greg was also pretty disgruntled with just the treatment in general that the employees were beginning to receive from the FAA. You know, he speaks about his injury and how they really did drag their feet in trying to help him recoup the costs. I mean, he had to go to the emergency room directly from work, and when he submitted an on-the-job injury claim, the agency initially said, no, it wasn't. And then they drug their feet in trying to pay the emergency room costs, which they needed to do, and again, trying to help him get the benefits. And he's actually, he went through months of physical therapy, and he's permanently disabled in the finger that was cut. So that coupled with just the attitude, the way the employees are treated in general now, it was just more than they could take, and that's what's really driving people to retire earlier than they want to, and what's causing a lot of these individuals to reconsider what they're doing. A lot of these new developmentals that are coming in are well-educated, and they've got other options that are available to them. It used to be that controllers would fight like the Dickens to remain employed with the FAA and continue in this career, and now people are saying, you know, I don't need to be treated like this. I don't need to give up my holidays with my family. And I don't want to give up. I'm going to have to work nights. And there are other things that this just isn't worth it for me. I'm going to go someplace else.
Doug, we appreciate your filling us in on some of the details of this circumstance. And we wish you continued success and safe operation at Salt Lake.
Thank you.
Doug Fincock is NATCA's facilities representative at Salt Lake Center. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.